AG got into the food supply in 2006 after mixing with other rice being grown near a test plot. Liberty Link is not considered harmful to humans, but it was never approved for human consumption by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Many farmers say they suffered financial losses after some foreign countries temporarily banned U.S. rice imports and prices dropped. If the judge grants the suit class action status, it could have major implications for the biotech seed industry because every major seed company grows experimental crops outdoors. Farmers say seed companies should be held liable for losses on global grain markets because of problems with experimental strains. For NPR News, I'm Matt Sepik in St. Louis.
And I'm Giles Snyder. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org.
A gift annuity offers benefits to you and WILL. With a gift annuity, you can convert stock or other appreciated property or low-interest investments into a high rate of guaranteed lifetime income. Annuity rates for nonprofit organizations will decrease effective July 1st. However, there's still time to lock in the current rates, maximizing the income you'll receive for life while also benefiting WILL. It's easy, and the process can be completed through the mail. For more information, contact WILL's Donda Beard at 217-333-1070.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting the local farmers market at the square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets, downtown Urbana. Information at 384-2444.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking about American politics with someone who has been writing about American politics for a long time, Thomas Byrne Edsel. And we'll talk about some of the ideas that you can find in his book, Building Red America, the subtitle, The New Conservative Coalition and the Drive for Permanent Power. The book is published by Basic, and it is available in paperback. And in this book, he makes the argument that while the two political parties, the major political parties here in the United States, attract about the same number of voters, the GOP, the Republicans, has an edge that it has maintained now for almost four decades. He goes on to say that while Republicans have been working very hard to control national policy, that so far they have not captured a majority of voters. And in this book, he argues that there is still time to rebalance politics to represent the competing interests of the American people. Our guest, Thomas Edsel, covered national politics for 25 years at the Washington Post. He is now correspondent for the New Republic and the National Journal. He was a guest columnist in 2006 for the New York Times and holds the Pulitzer Moore Chair in Public Affairs Journalism at Columbia University in New York and has authored a number of books about politics in America. Questions are certainly welcome. We encourage people to call in and ask questions, make comments. All we ask of callers is that people try to keep their comments and questions brief, so we can get in as many people as possible and keep the program moving along. But certainly, listeners are welcome to call in. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. So that's for local folks. But if it would be a long-distance call, whether you are listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or you're listening over the Internet, and that could be across the country, you can use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So once again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Edsel, hello.
How are you doing?
Good, thanks. And yourself?
Good. Good day here.
Appreciate you giving us some of your time. I suppose that just the basic place we could start out is to talk a little bit about the Republican Party and about the advantages that you say that the party has and have used to their advantage over the past several decades.
There are multiple advantages that they've capitalized on. The primary one is that the Republicans and their conservative movement generally has seen itself as under siege for years. It's from throughout the whole period when Democrats controlled Congress, And what they did is invested both conservative intellectual think tank money, the network of political action committees, and the party itself all became a unified force, in effect, for changing power in Washington. The same has not been true of the Democratic Party, where there tends to be more factionalism, but more so because the whole history of the party for the period from the New Deal into the 80s, they controlled Congress and controlled the White House for much of the time, and they never had to think in terms of putting together a coalition that could take over power. Instead, their main concerns were trying to influence their friends in power, and it made for a very different mentality.
Yeah. So it's you would say that it's not the case that the Republican Party never had those kind of divisions, but that over time that they've been able to deal with those divisions and get to a point where most people, most Republicans, are ideologically speaking on the same page, and that's one place where there is a big difference between the two parties.
Except once that's true. Once they obtain power, and now they've lost it in Congress, you began to see some serious divisions, particularly over matters like immigration, where you have the business wing of the party is very pro-immigration, wants cheap labor, in effect, and you have the more populist wing, which is much more anti-immigration. And the party came into power in Congress in 1994, really as a reformist movement, and within 10 years it became in many respects as self-dealing and corrupt as the Democratic Party did over 40 years. So it's not a perfect coalition, and they are struggling this year. There are other advantages that the Republican Party has, which may emerge in the presidential election. One of those advantages is that really a Democratic liability on values questions. And the big issue of this campaign will be whether the Republican Party will be able to turn Barack Obama into a Willie Horton-like figure over these various issues of Jeremiah Wright, his associations with people who used to be in the weathermen movement, and other factors like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, I suppose that some people would argue that Senator McCain has liabilities that are similar, perhaps not as intense. For example, just recently there's been some controversy about his having been endorsed by an evangelical Christian minister who said some things that upset a lot of folks. And I suppose as far as Senator McCain is concerned, that in spite of his embrace of campaign reform, there are these questions about his ties to lobbyists and the being able to play into the image that politics is dominated essentially by moneyed interests. Isn't that an opportunity for the Democrats to, in a sense, play some of the same kind of strategy?
No question. And the his support from John Hagee, which he renounced yesterday, could have been a very serious problem. He will see if he's cut off that debate quicker than Obama dealt with the Jeremiah Wright issue, which lingered on for about 2.5 weeks. In a slow death, basically conducted over cable television, not a good thing for Obama. The Hagee thing has sort of blown up more quickly, and the big issue came out yesterday on the Huffington Post, which I work for now, incidentally, and a tape of him talking about the Hitler and the Nazis almost doing the Jews a favor. Very bizarre tape. And bang, McCain dropped it. The issue of lobbyists and special interest forces in the McCain campaign is a ongoing and serious one and has not been resolved. And he has dealt with it similarly to the way Obama dealt with Jeremiah Wright. It's been a long, slow process with a new aide getting fired, a new revelation, and sort of a constant drip, drip, drip that's not going to help his campaign.
Just very quickly, our guest is Thomas Byrne Edsel. He covered national politics for the Washington Post for 25 years. He's now correspondent for the New Republic and the National Journal, has written widely on American politics. His most recent book is Building Red America, A New Conservative Coalition and the Drive for Permanent Power. That's the subtitle. It's out now in paper, published by Basic Books. Again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The battle for the Democratic presidential nomination has now gone on, I think, longer than anybody expected. It has been long, and it has been bruising for the participants. And certainly a lot has been said about divisions and what it says about divisions within the Democratic Party, about who it is that who supports whom among the candidates, and that being something of a challenge for whoever gets the nomination. And it looks as if, obviously, one doesn't know what's going to happen. It looks as if that's going to be Senator Obama. And there have been these questions about the willingness of particularly white working class people to support him. So definitely it seems that in an interesting way that we're maybe not used to talking about, social class has become an issue in the Democratic Party this year.
No question. Some colleagues of mine have written that it's the Obama campaign is the wine track campaign, and the Hillary campaign has been the beer track campaign. Obama has put together a fairly unique coalition. There have been candidates who've appealed to the sort of upscale, socially liberal wing of the party, like Bill Bradley, Tsongas, a number of people like that in the past. They've never done particularly well. Obama has done very well by adding to that coalition black voters, who are clearly a very strong factor in Democratic voting. And he basically has turned that into, in many cases, a majority of the Democratic primary electorate. Hillary has strength in her hand among white working-class voters, and her victories, her huge victories, really, in West Virginia and Kentucky, and her strong but not as big victories in Ohio and Pennsylvania, do not bode well for the Obama campaign in terms of his efforts to win white working-class voters in the general election. And McCain is going after those voters very hard, and they are likely to be the focal point of the campaign. Mm-hmm.
Well, is this kind of a split between Obama and Clinton over what kind of voters they attract, is that somehow emblematic of fundamental kind of divisions within the Democratic Party?
Yeah, it's been an ongoing conflict. You have, on the one hand, about 40% of the party is made up of college-educated, white, fairly affluent voters who are primarily, their issues are ones like abortion rights. They don't like the Christian right agenda. They tend to be suburban or center city kind of voters. And they also are very influential in terms of setting the party agenda. They're the kind of people who go to party conventions. 60%, though, of the party is made up of much more bread and butter poor people and lower middle class people who really see politics as a way to get assistance, to get programs that help them. Much more sort of, money is much more important to them. This has been an ongoing tension, and when Gore and Bill Bradley ran, you had a similar split, but the difference was that Gore decisively won the black vote. You had a similar split with Bill Clinton running against Paul Tsongas, but again, Clinton won the black vote. As I say, the big difference now is the switch of black voters to the candidate of the more upscale white community, with now Hillary depending on, relatively speaking, downscale whites for her core base.
You know, she is someone who she grew up in a relatively affluent middle class suburb, a place that I happen to know pretty well because I also grew up there. She went to a prestigious university. She was the First Lady of Arkansas. She was First Lady of the United States. She's now Senator from New York, and she and her husband together have a net worth of something over $100 million. How is it that someone like that has been so successful in positioning herself as somehow the candidate of the lower working class?
It is a pretty incredible process. If anything, when she was in office and Clinton was having his troubles in 1993-94, just before the Congress went Republican, it was probably just these same voters who turned against her and her husband dramatically. Clinton's the drop in support among whites without any college was the biggest drop from 92 to 94, 20 percentage points, which in politics is huge. But these people have now become her base. It shows how elastic politics are. It also shows, though, that Obama may be very worrisome to these voters, both perhaps because of his race, but also because of the kind of candidate he is. He is a editor of the Harvard Law Review. He is very well-spoken and intellectual in his tone and tenor. And he had the unfortunate experience of speaking at a fundraiser in San Francisco where he described people who believe in people who as clinging to their belief in God and their liking of guns as a substitute for their feelings because they are actually economically deprived. That does not sell well to people who believe in God and hunt and do those kind of things. They to a certain extent, became Hillary's by default, although she certainly also went after them. But he invited it to some extent.
One other quick question, then I have callers we'll get right to.
Sure.
There has been, I think among Democrats, there has been some concern about the divisions that this primary season have exposed, not created perhaps, but that they were already there, have made obvious, and concerns that when it comes time for the general election, will the party be able to heal up some of these divisions? And of course, one has heard a lot of stories where voters who said that they were supporting one or the other candidate, voters have said, well, if my candidate is not the nominee, then I'm not going to vote for the other person. One wonders about that, whether they would actually not vote at all or whether they would vote for Senator McCain. But what do you think about the potential for the party to, once everything is all over and once they have a nominee, to get itself knit back up again?
That process is always something that parties that have bitter primary fights have to go through. And the danger for the Democratic Party is that the longer this continues, the less time there is for that healing process. There's an extraordinary degree of really hatred of Obama voiced, especially by women who were very strong Hillary people. If you look on the web at various websites, the references to him are as derogatory almost as a Republican website. And healing that is going to be a big challenge. It always is a challenge, though, in fairness. This process has given advantage to McCain in two respects. One, he has had this time try to do that healing in his party, which also went through a very bitter fight. And secondly, it's given him a much larger window to raise money to finance ads and critiques of Obama that will go right to this division. I mean, from McCain's point of view, he wants those voters that are angry at Obama, who were Hillary people, and he will go after them tooth and nail. And this time period has been crucial to McCain and the Republican Party, which is both of which have not done well financially until this point. Now that they're in a position where they can coalesce and, most very importantly, raise money for the general election.
We have a couple of callers here. Let's talk with them. First in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I have two points I'd like to bring up. We seem to be referring to the working class voters. And it seems to me that there are two discrete groups that we're lumping together and which have very little in common. There are the industrial workers of Pennsylvania, Ohio, some of the other northern states, who had been Democrats, were largely pro-union, and have, to some extent, are socially conservative, but it seems to me they're very different from the group you find in West Virginia, eastern Kentucky, eastern Tennessee, which I don't mean to deride them, but they're the good old boys. They're rural, not urban, as the northern group are. They're largely mine workers and other industrial groups. But it's a very different social group. They tended to be segregationist in the distant past, although West Virginia did not go with the southern states. It stayed with the Union and was anti-slavery. But it seems to me these are very different groups, and the group that I see in West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, are almost an endangered species. They're with us today, but I think the social developments almost inevitably mean that they will not be with us in the future. The other thing is with the Republicans, you're right, I think, at the organizational level, they are not divided, or at least not nearly so much as they were at one time. But you have to remember that the Republican Party was the liberal party right up until at least the 60s. Roosevelt called them conservatives. That was nonsense. People like Dirksen were never conservative. They were traditional liberals. The conservatives were all in the Democratic Party until the 60s and 70s when they followed the Nixon strategy and came over to the Republican Party. So that you have a group, particularly out in Kansas and Iowa and the Midwest, who were for almost a century liberals by any definition. They were bitterly anti-slavery. They were opposed to segregation. They are still in the Republican Party. They tend to have rather conservative social values, but they are the antithesis of the true conservatives and the industrial business element of the party. In fact, they were tended to be progressives politically, and the followers of Jennings, William Jennings Bryan, in the early part of the century. And it seems to me this is a dichotomy that has to tear apart eventually. Would you care to comment?
That's a complex question. On the first one, about the, sort of the substantial differences between the West Virginia and Kentucky voter and the more industrialized Ohio, Pennsylvania voter, that is true, but I think both of them fit into the category. What unifies them is that they both were what you could call Reagan Democrats or silent majority Republicans. They both moved to the Republican Party or there were gains made by the Republican Party among both constituencies during the civil rights and women's rights and the whole rights revolution period, sexual revolution and so forth. So in a certain sense, they have that in common. Secondly, I think the working class as such, it's a bad phrase now, because so many, in fact, of these same voters now work in the service industries.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find them doing stuff, working on computers, in computer stores. They are people who have high school degrees, maybe a little bit of post-high school training. In fact, very likely some post-high school training, but not college degrees necessarily. And they do white-collar work in many respects, although the pay is pretty lousy. It's like being the assistant manager of a dark drugstore where all you get is your top pay is $42,000 a year, something like that. And so, at any rate, it's a broader constituency and with a much more complex workplace experience than in the past. The issue about the Republican Party having once been a liberal party, that's true, but the party really went through a revolution in 1964 and afterwards. And if you look at it, and not just the leadership, but actually the voters, and this is true in reverse of Democrats, there is a real consistency among what they call issue consistency among Republican voters, where they share the same views, basically the conservative views, on social issues and economic issues. And that conflict and tension is much less the case than it used to be. There's much less diversity, ideological diversity, within the Republican Party. And the same is true among Democrats, where there's also much more liberal issue constituency on issues, and you tend to find a real there's been a realignment of the parties over the past 40 years where they
I would agree with you about the realignment. I think you really need to extend the working class into a higher income group. You have computer programmers, technical people, who to all intents and purposes are working class, but they're white collar. On the Republican side, I think you're right that these people are socially conservative in that they're much more religious, much more concerned with issues like abortion. On the other hand, economically, they're not. And they have very, very little in common with the true conservatives. In fact, they tend to be populist in most of their views when you get away from religion. And I think this is a dynamic that has to play out in the future. These people have no place in a Republican Party.
I'll tell you the problem, in a certain sense, what you're suggesting is the kind of the argument, not, you may disagree, but that Tom Franks makes in What's the Matter with Kansas, that these people, their economic interests are being violated by the or conflict with their votes. Two points. One is a lot of these voters see the Democratic Party as no longer representing their interests, even though it might have a better tax policy for them, a better jobs program. They see, and a lot of this comes out of race, where a lot of these voters see the Democratic Party has now tilting in favor of blacks at the expense of whites. The second thing is that for many of these voters, the values issues are economic issues. If you're the father of a steel worker or a former steel worker who now is the assistant manager of a computer store, and you look at your sons and daughters, the idea that they would adopt a radical point of view, or that when they hand out condoms at school, that suggests that your kids are likely to either get pregnant or get someone else pregnant. You see those things as being very economically threatening to you, and if you think your son, because he's been, whatever you want to call it, radicalized, may start talking back to his teacher or talking back to the drugstore where he works, the boss at the drugstore where he works part-time, he could lose his part-time job. All those carry economic weight, and it's dangerous not to recognize the importance economically to these voters of those issues.
I need to...
I'm not sure that the Democratic Party has addressed those liabilities.
I need to jump in here because we're past our midpoint here, and I want to introduce again our guest and invite some other folks to call and be a part of the conversation. We're talking with Thomas Edsel. He has been a reporter covering American politics for a long time, for 25 years. He was working at the Washington Post. He's now a correspondent for the New Republic and the National Journal. He also holds the Pulitzer Moore Chair in Public Affairs Journalism at Columbia University in New York, and has authored several books on American politics, including one that is titled Building Red America, A New Conservative Coalition and the Drive for Permanent Power. That's the subtitle. It is out now in paperback. It's published by Basic Books, and questions are certainly welcome. And of course, you can find the book out in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm sure that there are some people, some Americans, who would say that they would have a difficult time identifying with the Democratic Party because they feel that it is too liberal on the social and cultural kinds of issues. At the same time, I think that it's true that within the Democratic Party, there are people, and maybe they're the more liberal members of the Democratic Party, who feel that the party has been moved too far to the center. It has become more conservative, and I suppose the one person who gets identified with that is Bill Clinton, who felt that in order to be successful, the party needed to be dragged more to the center, ideologically speaking. So I find myself wondering how it is that both of these things can be true about the party.
Getting into a whole mare's nest. But it's a very important one. There are two critiques of the Democratic Party. One of them is that, from really what you might call the John Edwards wing, that it is too accommodating economically to forces like the lobbying community and so forth, that it should not be conceding to those interests. The other is that it is too liberal on social issues, and therefore it alienates the people that the previous caller and I were talking about, more downscale but socially conservative voters. This is all you can say is this is an ongoing debate that animates the party and has been very, very, it's an unresolved issue. If you look at the record, just if all you care about is winning, the only two presidential candidates the Democratic Party has had that have won have been socially moderate candidates from southern states, Arkansas and Georgia. There are economic populists who contend that if only the party would adopt a very strong populist point of view, then all those voters who have been alienated would join forces and the party would win big. The John Edwards campaign poses something of a dilemma for them, though, because he failed with that kind of message, even within the Democratic Party. These are debates that combine the issue of winning and losing with the issue of what's right and wrong, and they make for very interesting debates, which I would be glad to engage in, but they, my own tendency has been to believe that the first obligation of a political party is to win so that it can then at least partially represent the interests of its constituents, and then try as best it can to fulfill its obligations to those constituents.
I'm kind of curious about or interested in returning to this point that you partly touched on with the previous caller, and that is how it is that the two parties are struggling for people that might be either ideologically or economically in the middle range who could indeed go either way. And why it is that it seems that people who you would think their economic interests would lie with people who are maybe a little bit more disadvantaged, why it is they seem to identify with the people that are the most advantaged?
Well, one of the characteristics of America, or if you want to call it American exceptionalism, is that the people think they are Horatio Alger, that they will be the millionaire, the movie star, whatever it is, that success is around the corner. And they identify with, in effect, the winner, not the loser. And this is a very strong current in American politics, American culture, American thinking generally. And in doing political analysis or looking at the country, you shouldn't just think in terms of people's static economic interest, where they are right now and what would be their best choice on tax or spending. You have to think in terms of what they think their future prospects could be. And this is a country that takes a lot of risks, that gambles in a sense, and people to some extent are willing to risk their present against the future. That has liabilities, but it also has a lot of strengths, and it's one of the reasons why the Republican Party has been so successful.
Well, let's talk with another listener here, someone in Buckley. This is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I'm always wondering why we're limited to this two-party system. It's the downfall of the U.S. Why doesn't a certain segment of the conservative Republican Party bolt from the party? I was thinking of 1948 election, I think it was, or very progressive Democrats bolt from the Democratic Party, or the blacks bolt from the Democratic Party and set up their own party. I spent a lot of time in Canada, and the labor movement there had their own party, the NDP, there's the liberals, the conservatives, the Reform Party. I was a great supporter of Ross Perot. So why are we stuck with this two-party system? It just doesn't work. I have nobody to vote for this year. I'm never going to vote for McCain, even though I'm a conservative, and I definitely won't vote for Obama or Clinton. So why isn't there a split?
You can say the system does exclude you. That's an unfortunate. Maybe it doesn't exclude you at other times. I don't know if you supported George Bush, Ronald Reagan, or any of those candidates before McCain. But to entirely fault the system in the fashion you did, the advantage of a two-party system is that it makes it possible to govern. Multiple party systems, take, for example, the Israeli Knesset. There are, I don't know how many parties, and the end result is you have to put together a coalition that does not work, and Olmert in Israel is having a great deal of trouble making any progress on any front because he has so many conflicting parties within his coalition. If you divide things 50-50, the one who gets 51 gets to govern. And there are real costs because the person who's outside either of those two parties is left out, but it also is a means to be able to get legislation passed to act in the case of emergencies and many other things. If you want a system where everyone's represented, that works at perhaps at a town meeting kind of level, but it is hard in a country the size of ours to have that kind of system.
Good. Does that get at your question, caller? You want to follow up?
Well, I think that when the executive, well, I obviously favor a parliamentarian type of system, but when the executive is opposed to the what people who control Congress, you have this deadlock and this people have to give way or have to compromise anyway. So what's the difference? If having a multi-party system where they have to compromise, or whether the president is of different party than those in Congress? It's the same, to me, it's the same situation.
Well, one is that in some cases, the multi-party system means that no action gets done whatsoever, that you can't even get a compromise out of your own coalition because their interests are so conflicting. Secondly, in England you have a parliamentary system, but it's basically a two-party system with a Liberal Party being a very minor fringe party. There you can, because it is a two-party system and the prime minister, in effect, is the leader of his party or her party, you can get action and policies and so forth. That is one system that does work, but it works because it is really a two-party system.
Oh, well, okay, I sort of agree with some of your points, but I think America would be much better off if it had a multi-party system where people could vote their true beliefs and they wouldn't have to compromise or make decisions not to vote just because they don't like any of the three candidates that are our only choice. Mm. And I resent the fact that McCain thinks that conservatives are going to obviously vote for him because he's the lesser of three candidates. I think conservatives are not going to vote for him.
Well, I appreciate the comments. I expect, Mr. Edsall, that there are other people listening who would certainly agree with the caller. How would you react to the, let's set aside the difficulty of governing in a parliamentary system, set aside that question and say that some people would argue that before you even get to that point, what you have to have is the possibility of a viable alternative to the two major parties, and that's not going to happen because the two parties control the system. And they write the rules, and they have stacked the deck that makes it next to impossible for a third party to mount a serious challenge.
I tend not entirely to agree with that. If there was a real popular base for a third party, when Ross Perot ran, if he had not been such really a nutcase kind of candidate, he conceivably could have established a party that over time could have supplanted either the Democratic or Republican Party and become a new party. He worked hard and was able to get past a lot of the hurdles. And a lot of those hurdles have now been struck down because of court rulings that he won in terms of getting access to the ballot. So there has to be a lot of support, and really it helps to have a lot of money to get something like this. But the I wouldn't rule out a third party movement.
We have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Just very quickly, let me introduce again the guest. Thomas Edsall is talking with us. He covered national politics for 25 years at the Washington Post. He's now a correspondent for the New Republic and the National Journal. He also teaches at Columbia University. He has authored several books about American politics, including one titled Building Red America, The New Conservative Coalition and the Drive for Permanent Power. That is the subtitle. It's available in paperback from Basic Books. We have another caller here in Belgium, not too far away, and this is line 4. Hello.
Good morning. In your discussions I've been listening to and all the debate about whose strength is where, with which group is whatever, we've kind of glossed over the fact that in the last two elections, Mr. Bush really didn't win the election. There was a little hanky-panky went on, and lo and behold, we ended up with Mr. Bush. And that's not the first time in our history that's happened. Would you like to address how that plays into our political system?
I think it's arguable that in the 2000 election, Gore did win the popular vote, and then he may have had it stolen from him in Florida. And to have a president picked by one faction of the Supreme Court was pretty, very dubious. I think it's harder to make the case that the election was stolen from John Kerry in 2004. Bush's margin of, 3.5 million votes was substantial enough that it's hard to figure 3.5 million illegally cast votes or 3.5 million votes cut off from Kerry. Elections probably have been stolen in the past. Nixon was convinced that Mayor Daley stole the election from him in Chicago in 1960 when Illinois went for Kennedy by a very slim margin with very late returns coming in from Chicago. We don't know if it happened. If a Democratic president comes in, he can appoint U.S. attorneys who may well look into those allegations, and we'll see what happens. In the meantime, I think you have to look to the future, and in the case of Ohio, for example, the controversial Secretary of State there is no longer Secretary of State, Ken Blackwell. There was a lot of accusations against him. He's no longer in office. A Democrat is in office. And now is the time to look to the future.
Thank you very much.
All right. We're coming down to the point where we have 3-4 minutes left, and I'm interested in having you talk to finish up a little bit about what, if you were going to be advising the Democratic Party on its platform and its approach in the coming election, what sort of advice would you give them?
Well, I don't think you would advise the Democratic Party. Barack Obama appears likely to be, in effect, the Democratic Party or the leading figure for it. And I think that if he's going to survive this election, he has to be tougher than he has been. He has countered McCain criticisms by saying that McCain is being divisive or that these are sort of adjectival, descriptive characterizations of McCain. He's got to take McCain head on, and if he's going to make the case for his foreign policy, he's got to make a much stronger case that the McCain and Bush approaches have worked counter to American interests. He's got to make that much more specific, much more tougher, and actually make the case. I mean, if you want to argue that the Bush administration has actually empowered Iran, you have to spell that out, how that happened, so that voters can understand it and that there was a groundwork under your case. And I don't think Obama has done that adequately, and the Democratic Party is going to have to follow up on that. I think it's going to be a very tough election, and foreign policy is going to play a major role, and the ability to convey a quality of being authoritative, competent, and tough is going to be crucial, and that's what the have been weaknesses in the past for the Democratic Party, and that they're going to have to address.
Do you? It seems to me that at least the past couple of elections, we have seen an electorate that is increasingly very narrowly split. Certainly, there were not runaway victories for anybody, and one would point out that even though it might have been a clear win for President Bush the second time, that something approaching 48% of the people who voted did not vote for him.
Yep.
And I think there are some people who would say that in the future that that's just kind of the way that it's going to be, that it is going to be closely divided and that the margin of victory is going to be narrow, and it's going to be whoever can, by hook or crook, somehow manage just to squeak by enough to get elected. Do you think that in fact is the way that it's going to be now for the foreseeable future?
I don't think that was really the fundamental calculation of the Bush campaign in 2004, that the electorate was precisely evenly divided. I'm not sure that is going to stay that way, and it's conceivable you could have a larger margin, especially in this case where you have McCain, who does not fit the mold of the Republican Party precisely, and Obama, who clearly is a new candidate in many respects, and you could well see a very different kind of outcome.
Well, there we're going to have to leave it with the suggestion that if you'd like to read more of the thoughts of our guest, you look for the book Building Red America. It's by our guest, Tom Edsall. He is a reporter now, correspondent for The New Republic and the National Journal. He also covered national politics for 25 years at The Washington Post. This book is just out now in paper, published by Basic Books. And also maybe one thing I'd mention real quick, if you're interested in politics, you might want to tune in for Media Matters, a program that happens here on AM 580 on Sundays. The host of the show is Bob McChesney. He talks with a lot of different people about media and politics. And this time, this week, the guest will be someone who is very high-profile political commentator. The guest will be Arianna Huffington. Now, this is a show that was pre-recorded, so they won't be taking phone calls, but I'm sure that she will have some interesting things to say. So that's Media Matters on Sunday afternoon at 1 here on AM 580. And Mr. Edsall, we all say to you, thanks very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
This program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates offers 4 area locations, including one on the lower level of the Illini Union at the Oasis. Coming up in the next part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about some of the financial difficulties being encountered and confronted by state governments across the country. State finances are deteriorating, and there are a lot of places where they're having serious budget gaps. In fact, at this point, 16 states have said they've got budget shortfalls, and for fiscal 2009, things look even worse. We'll be talking about that in the next hour with Todd Donovan. He's professor of political science at Western Washington University. That's coming up in a little bit. First, though, we'll break for an update on the markets and news, so stay tuned.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Lernard Seed Service, an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products to farmers in East Central Illinois. Lernard Seed Service provides customer services and agronomic information to help customers maximize profits. Lernard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at the Chicago Board of Trade. Soybean futures have double-digit gains at mid-session. Following higher, the red-hot crude oil market. For the last several sessions, soybeans have been moving in tandem with crude oil, which has hit this past week several new all-time contract highs. Let's go ahead and look at particulars. We'll do that by beginning in the soybean pit, where July is now trading at 13.61.5, up 36.75. August, 13.64.5, up 36.25. September, 13.60, up 35.75. And November at 13.48, up 23.75. Compare that to the outside market, We're looking at August crude oil. It's now 133.15, up 225. The July at 131.80 is up 99 cents, as being as high today as 133.69.